Hello, it's Dr. Howard Gerfer for The Shrink Is In, and today I'm very pleased to have Dr. Skip Rizzo, one of the pioneers in virtual reality, as my guest. Skip is a clinical psychologist, neuropsychologist, and director of medical virtual reality at the University of Southern California Institute for Creative Technology. He's also a research professor with the USC Department of Psychiatry and at the USC Davis School of Gerontology. Yep, welcome to The Shrink Is In.
Thank you. I appreciate you offering me the time to chat with you.
Listen, I have been following you for years in the background because I've been immensely impressed with the work you do. I see you as one of the icons in virtual reality. So I'm pleased that you agreed.
Well, thank you very much. There's not too many folks in virtual reality, or there hasn't been until recently, but there's been quite a bit of excitement over the last couple of years. So the field's getting a little more crowded now. So
I don't think it could be crowded. I think it's still got a way to go. You know, because I've been in the background, and it was just way too expensive an investment for a private practitioner like myself. So now, obviously, with the advent of using, you know, cell phones and Gear VRs or even Oculus or Vive, those kind of technologies, it's actually reachable now. So I'm thrilled because I've always seen it as like the gold standard of working with phobic patients.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, you know, we have seen this incredible set of advances in all the enabling technologies for VR. You know, the display technology that you describe, I mean, that's really been driven over the last, say, 5 years based on the mass production of cell phone screens that are high resolution. You know, when you can mass produce these screens, then all of a sudden you can find other uses for them. So they end up in virtual reality headsets. You know, I can remember to get a screen of sufficient resolution to build a headset 5 years ago, it cost $2,500 an eye. And now they're, because mass production, they're literally, you know, pennies. So, you know, that's just one element of it. You know, the computer processing, the speed of computing, the graphic fidelity that can be achieved now with new graphic technologies, the interface devices, all these things have come together, you know, to really take the vision that, you know, we had back in the 90s for how VR could be applied clinically, and made it, you know, really a real reality.
Yeah. So you've been in this for like 20 years.
Thereabouts. Yeah. Yeah. I got first engaged around 93. I went to a conference called VR and Persons with Disabilities, and that was an eye opener for me. I'd already been kicking around the idea that we needed to bring better stimulus presentation technology into clinical work and research, and part of that was driven by, you know, the development of computer games. I was actually working with folks with traumatic brain injuries. I worked in a cognitive rehab center, and very hard to motivate people to do traditional rehab, but when you would put them in front of a, you know, what we would call primitive by today's standards, you put them in front of a Nintendo NES game, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden they're engaged and they're focused and they would do the task. And that was my first light bulb that went off. I had a patient who was playing with one of the early Game Boys, and, you know, a kid I couldn't motivate for more than 10 minutes to do cognitive rehab tasks, but here he was glued to this Game Boy, becoming a Tetris warlord, you know, and basically it just really showed me that, you know, if we can put this kind of rehab content in a fun and engaging graphic-based environment, we might be able to get people compelled to do this kind of boring, repetitive, kind of frustrating activity in rehab. And it just grew from there. I'd heard about VR from an NPR report. It was Jaron Lanier talking about a virtual kitchen application in Japan where, you know, Japanese customers could go to a department store, put on a headset, put on some data gloves, and design their kitchen in VR, pick the refrigerator, change the color, move it around. And, and that's when it all came together in the rehab area, because I started thinking, well, geez, we could build simulated functional environments, and we could systematically deliver drill and practice rehab activities in that context, and maybe, you know, get people to do the tasks and get them to do them in sort of a game-based way, but also promote transfer of learning or transfer training generalization to the real world by doing it in a realistic context. So that's how the ideas all sort of, you know, came together. I went to this conference in 93, and nobody was doing anything in the cognitive area. And people were just starting to talk about exposure therapy then. And, and then 94, 95, it picked up, and I started our lab at USC in the tail end of 95, really beginning in 96. And, you know, at that point, it was just a vision because the technology was really, really poor. You know, thank God the technology's caught up with the vision. But, you know, in fact, I would say that 1995, that was the start of the nuclear winter of virtual reality, where there had been so much hype and so much excitement about the technology, you know, kind of like there is today, but the technology that wasn't there to deliver on it. And gradually, it's gotten better.
Oh, yeah. When I first was looking at it, I think the equipment costs alone were like $100,000 when I first started. Mm-hmm. And then about, I don't know, five or six years ago, it dropped down significantly, but still was not really plausible for someone like me. It was just too expensive, and I was waiting and waiting. And I think I talked to you many years ago about the ADHD environment, because I used to work as a school psychologist as well, and so I had, you know, my private practice and the school psychology job, and I just thought that was like the most ideal way to assess ADHD with kids, because it was as real as you were going to get, as opposed to putting him in front of a computer and having just a letter, you know, flash, you know, the standard Connors or you know, the Tova,
right.
You know, to put him in an environment where, you know, literally they're immersed in a schoolroom, and you could see what happens when a car goes by or a kid sneezes or, you know, something else happens. It was a perfect way to assess them.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that application is still near and dear to my heart. And you bring up one that really illustrates what the challenges were back then, because actually that application ended up getting productized by the Psychological Corporation around 2003. We put it together, built it really well, ran a couple of tests with it, and got really good data. And then we went to INS, International Neuropsych Society, and we did focus groups with practicing neuropsychologists. And they all loved the concept of it, but they all said, well, we're not going to spend, you know, $3,000 for a virtual reality headset, or we're not going to, you know, this is, you know, a little too far out of the box at the time. And so PsyCor basically abandoned the project, and the rights reverted back to me, and now I'm looking to put it on the Gear VR, where it runs off a mobile phone. And, you know, at that point, when a psychologist can pull a headset out of their desk drawer, no computer, no wire, give it to a client, now you're talking about something that is widely disseminable and, you know, at a low cost.
I think it's ideal. You know, as a clinician, I'd pick it up in a second. But, you know, to get past, let's say, a school district's budget and say, you have to pay for, you know, $3,000 for this, it would never fly.
Right.
So the market wasn't even there, because no one could pick that up in terms of just the expenditures alone.
Right.
But,
so, you know, basically since that time, what we did was we basically gave the application away to researchers. And there's been a reasonable literature, maybe 10, 12 papers that have come out testing different elements of it. There was an NIH study that was using it recently. And so now we've got some data that further supports its value. And so now in the development of it to run a very low-cost system, I think we'll be a little bit stronger ground, and maybe I'll go knocking at Pearson's door, I guess Pearson, but PsyCor.
Yeah, right, yeah. The fact that it was much more generalizable, and then that's the whole thing about virtual reality to me, is that it's a treatment approach that's generalizable to real life faster than any other thing I've used before.
Yeah, you know, I think in some sense you can view it as the ultimate Skinner box, but, you know, with the idea of stimulus control, but within realistic context, you know. I mean, one of the gold standard elements of all work in our clinical domain is, does it matter in the real world? So if you can test, train, teach, or treat in a context, a simulated context that, is relevant to a real-world context, I think you're going to see better generalization. And we definitely see that with the phobia area, you know.
Right.
And people have directly tested that with things like Barbara Rothbaum's early work with a virtual version of a glass elevator at the Marriott Hotel in Atlanta, where there was a real glass elevator. So you could bring clients there before treatment and see how high they would go up, which was typically they barely would get in the door before they'd run out.
Right.
And then do the treatment, and then you'd have a behavioral analog, you know, the real glass elevator, and you'd see them flying up to the top. So, I think that's always been, the core asset is, you know, the ecologically relevant environment and systematic control of stimulus presentation. You know, you can't even do it in the real world very easily. I mean, you can, but the real world isn't always the best place to do training, or definitely not always the best place to do therapy.
Well, even the fear of flying modules that every company has, you know, you can't get somebody on a plane these days, you know, you can't go through security. So the virtual environment just solves so many issues of getting to that particular problem the most efficient way. You know, the old days you had to say, okay, sit on the couch, imagine that you're on a plane. Close your eyes and imagine you're on a plane, and then describe the environment that you're in, and in hope to kind of immerse them in that environment. But nobody could hold on to that. Right. And so, you know, they couldn't. They couldn't maintain the, didactic imagery that they were trying to create. But this way, I don't even have to bother with that anymore.
Right, right. You know, and I think it's even underscored more when you're talking about something like PTSD, where, you know, one of the core symptoms, one of the core criteria of PTSD is avoidance. So here you're asking somebody to graphically, visually, you know, engage in a trauma memory, and we never know what's going on in the hidden world of imagination. I believe there's been studies looking at skin conductance while people go through trauma narratives, and, you know, people that are way less activated, not engaged in the trauma memory, are less likely to see a therapeutic benefit. We certainly don't have that problem with VR.
Mm-hmm.
We put, whether it's somebody with a fear of flying or public speaking or heights or PTSD, these folks are very primed to react. Anything that has a whiff of what they're afraid of or is anxiety producing, and even if it's not an exact replica of reality, it's enough to get them activated and at the core of prolonged exposure. You were mentioning you were using a system out of Spain that runs on cell phone on a Gear VR.
So yeah, I've been using the Sios software out of Spain, and generally the response is very positive. For what it does and for the cost and for the effectiveness, it's definitely worthwhile. And I think really only the beginning. I think Samsung is coming out with a 4K phone on the next round, which should make it a lot more immersive.
Well, you know, I think we're going to see great advances, like you're talking about with the Samsung 4G. It's not going to stop there. The stuff is just going to continue to be driven by the consumer end of the market. And that bodes well for us, because now we can use these lower cost systems, for a good clinical purpose. I was in a Vive headset last night, and I was, I had tried it a few times before, but I actually spent about an hour in it last night.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, really impressed. I think I have a hard time seeing how things can get almost much better. I mean, the interactivity, the graphic fidelity, and the update rate of the tracking to my head and body movement was really, I mean, I almost forgot I was in VR for a while, playing some of the games and doing some of the experiences that they had. And I think it's just a matter of time before these systems become cheaper and more available. And, you know, eventually when they get to the point where they're, you know, a VR headset is like a toaster, you know, you might not use it every day, but every house got one. You know, that kind of penetration will make it so that people start having these experiences and they start maybe to expect that some of their entertainment and some of their learning and maybe some of their therapy will be delivered in these devices. I think that's going to be the turning point. I think one turning point is when Sony releases their headset for the PlayStation, and, you know, every kid in America is going to want one for Christmas. And then parents will try it, you know, and it's like, oh, so this is what all the hullabaloo is about. And I think that's going to increase attraction because, you know, honestly, there's a lot of hype and there's, you know, folks like us that have been kind of following it. But the general public is not a big percent. In fact, I presented at a conference on Saturday at Cedars-Sinai to psychologists and medical professionals. And I brought a gear with me, and I asked out to the crowd, I go, how many people have actually tried an immersive VR headset? And it was like 10% of the whole audience. So I basically tossed the gear out to them, and I had an application running, and I said, just pass it around and turn your head and look around. And, you know, then you start seeing the jaws drop, and people start to get what we're talking about, that it's not just like playing a video game. It's like being in the video game, and it's not necessarily about video games either. It's about, you know, clinical environments. That conference was very focused on the use of VR for pain distraction, and that's a big area that's up and coming as well. In fact, a lot of companies are focusing on this now because it's a slam dunk. You know, we basically, you know, with all these VR applications, we always start from what we know works in the real world. We know exposure works. It's, you know, meat and potatoes, conditioning and learning. We know that enhancing rehab by making it fun and engaging is a way to improve brain function and reacquire function. We know that distracting someone, occupying their attention away from pain, will reduce the perception of pain. And therein lies the value for VR in that, because we can put people in very compelling and engaging virtual environments and distract their attention away from an acutely painful medical procedure and have something that might reduce reliance on opiate medications at certain points. And that, you know, as you know, that's a big issue right now.
Oh, yeah. So the company that the Sios, this company, I've been talking to them for a while about dental environments.
Yep.
You know, and so apparently that's one of the environments they're coming out with. Also an MRI to reduce, you know, the anxiety of getting into an MRI machine, not the distraction while you're in the machine.
Right.
You know, that's a whole different ballgame. I know somebody's done some research on that where they had some kind of, I guess, plastic tubing or something that they used to get into the tube with the person to create a virtual environment while they're there, because you obviously can't use anything with metal.
Right.
But that was an interesting concept as well.
So
your work has been oriented towards returning vets, you know, and so I wanted to know if you could address the Brave Mind and also, you know, the Strive program that you guys have been working on.
Yeah, well, you know, Brave Mind came from an idea based on a video game. Back in 2003, I saw a video game called Full Spectrum Warrior. I saw a video clip of it, and it just struck me as a rich Iraq-like environment. And so it turned out that USC had a hand in developing this game that was on the Xbox. And in fact, the Army had funded it because it was actually a combat tactical simulation game. It wasn't a first-person shooter. And this was going to be the follow-up to America's Army, which was a Army game that they distributed free to, you know, kind of make
right.
being in the Army seem cool. And so they did this game, and USC had had a hand in it. So I reached out to the folks that had developed it, and I said, look, can we just try to retool some of this game and make an exposure therapy application for returning service members? Or, mind you, we're still sort of in the mission accomplished era, so people weren't anticipating it. In fact, when we applied for funding later in 2004, one of the reviewers said, oh, we're not going to have another Vietnam. This war will be over early and all that stuff. Well, anyway, we did build a prototype off the game, but it was limited, but enough for us to get service members to try it and to weigh in and tell us what we had gotten right and what we got wrong with it. And we leveraged that feedback for when we did get funded in 2005 to build out a clinical version. We had a lot of feedback from service members that had been in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we got off to a good start with real good user-centered feedback to inform the development and design of the application. And we went on and built a four-world application, you know, a couple of driving scenarios, a Middle Eastern city, a U.S. desert environment, sort of a toe in the water, and released that. And early clinical test of it showed pretty positive results. And in some cases, people who had not benefited from traditional imaginal exposure or other evidence-based or early evidence-based approaches like cognitive processing therapy, when they went into the VR therapy, they did quite well. And so that went on for a few years, and that application had gotten distributed to about 70 sites, VAs and Army medical centers, university clinics. And then around 2011, we got funded. Based on the success of it, at that point, we got more funding to update it and to put it in more current software and to build out what we couldn't afford to build the first time, and that was the diversity of content that was needed. So, you know, at this point, clinicians and patients were narrating their stories, telling their stories, and we were finding out that we needed an Afghan village. We needed an industrial area. We needed both Iraq and Afghan marketplaces because they were somewhat different. People noticed that. That's what we did for a couple of years. We went back to the drawing board and completely revamped everything, built a 14-world scenario, and expanded the features so that now we can pretty much put anybody that served in Iraq and Afghanistan in a context that resembles something like what they may have had bad experiences in. And the clinician has a control panel that allows them to adjust the time of day, lighting, sound effects, ambient sounds, actuate animations of explosions, jets flying over, insurgents shooting from behind corners and things like that. And so now, you know, we've got this relatively high-powered scenario that this version is out at about 40 sites, but I'm expecting that it will it'll expand rapidly because we are going to officially announce shortly a partnership with Dell and AMD graphic cards and possibly Vive, where they're going to provide free equipment to any VA or certified mental health center that has people that would be, you know, well trained to be able to deliver this kind of therapy. And so, you know, with the software essentially being free because it's Army, you know, Army funded it and it's general right. government purpose rights, the equipment being free, then the only cost really is in somebody to go and set it up and put it all together. And, you know, we have partnerships with the industry. We work with Virtually Better currently, who, you know, they don't sell software because we can't sell the software, but they sell right. the service of, you know, because a lot of times VAs, they don't want to mess around with purchasing the equipment and integrating a headset and this and that. So, Virtually Better has been a good partner in doing that and providing training to clinicians because, you know, you've got to start off with a base of knowing exposure therapy to begin with, but then being, you know, certified in prolonged exposure. But then now you got to learn the interface, the equipment with the VR, how to operate it, and how to do exposure using a VR tool. So there still are needs, but we're chipping away at some of the barriers. And that's the exciting part for me. That and the idea of translating everything we've learned from the military to civilian needs. So, An example of that is we're working with a group in France and also a group is contributing from Greece and Portugal to build out a virtual Paris scenario for the victims of the terrorist attacks over there. And we've got the theater, the Bacchanalan Theater, mapped out now. We have characters in it. We've got the group in Greece building out the outside of the sports area. And I believe the folks in Portugal are working on some of the cafes. And, you know, that's very exciting that, you know, we can take something. You know, I always like to say war sucks, but it always drives innovation in medicine and mental health and rehabilitation. You know, a lot of people don't know this, but NIMH was actually formed from an executive order by Harry Truman to address combat neurosis after World War II. So one of the outcomes of World War II is the startup of the VA internship program and Harry Truman's executive order. So it had a significant impact on psychology. And I think, you know, what we're going to see now is the urgency of war driving a lot of technological innovations in mental health and rehab and prosthetic devices that are now going to have significant impact on the civilian sector. So all the stuff we're learning with VR in a military context, I think will be easily transferable to help, you know, victims of terrorist attacks or of physical or sexual assaults or motor vehicle accidents, extreme weather, any kind of trauma that, you know, the mass majority of people may be exposed to in the course of their lifetime.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fascinating. And then, yeah, you're right. When it hits the point where it's saturating the market and it's going to be, I guess, found to be very effective in its ability to improve people's lives, we're going to see more and more of it. People are going to be jumping on the ship, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it'll become commonplace. You know, and I don't want to carry it too far because, I really believe that the best thing we can do for our patients is give them an array of options that are all evidence-based, of course. But, right. You know, we always have to consider patient choice in this. And, you know, I think I'll be the first person to say that VR may appeal to a younger generation, digital generation of service members or anyone. There may be folks that, you know, might feel better just doing it in their own mind with exposure or in other approaches. So, you know, I don't think we have to worry about, you know, eliminating or virtualizing all forms of therapy. But I think where it makes sense, you know, we provide it as an option and hopefully we find the right patients that benefit from what treatment. I think that's an important issue there. But it will become more commonplace. I have no doubt. You know, I'm looking at what Google is doing right now in the education area. You know, they put out a program called Expeditions, which uses the Google Cardboard cell phone delivered headset device, and they use a lot of spherical video of, and their motto is to bring your students to places the school bus can't go.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's integrating into a lot of areas of society and culture. And certainly the technology is not going to fold up its tent and go away. It's, in fact, going to get better over time. And so I think we're going to see more and more adoption of this. And where it makes sense. I think we've talked about some of the core topics here. You know, in anxiety disorders, PTSD, pain distraction, rehab. These are all areas where you can draw a good connection between what the technology affords and what the needs of the clinical application are. So I guess we let the market and our patients guide us as we move forward.
Yeah. No, and I really, I thank guys like you who've made this plausible because you guys were the pioneers. You know, I'm just glad to be the recipient of all the research that's been done because it's such a clear-cut connection, and it makes so much clinical sense to me. That's why I've been sitting in the background waiting patiently for this to happen.
Well, you've been a supporter, so you're part of it. I think we will see more folks as they get experience with it feel the same way you do.
I do, you know, and it's interesting because I do talk to psychologists and they don't know what it is, you know, and I explain it to them, and every one of them looks at me and goes, wow, that's a good idea. You know? And so, you know, I think they'll all catch on.
Well, you know, well, good news is the last 20 years, as hard as it has been to convince a mass market of clinicians to use this stuff, there has been a good literature evolved around it. It's probably the most evolved scientific literature of any application area of VR, and that's in the clinical area. I mean, really, there has been a good bit of research. You know, some of it is you know, small and no control group, of course, you know, very beginning stages.
Right.
But it's gotten better over the years, and it's continuing to evolve. And now, because of the recognition, it's a little bit easier to get funding so that you can do the clinical trials. The big challenge we had early on was that, you know, you go to NIH for funding, they don't want to pay a big technology development tab. They just want to pay for the trial. So, you know, then you go to NSF and you say, well, I want to build this application for clinical use. Oh, well, that's a clinical application. Go to NIH. You know, so
right.
it was a catch 22. But now we've got low cost technology and easy development. A lot of people developing in the field. I think there, in the last year, there's been something like 12 or 14 new mental health focused VR companies that have popped up. And so there'd be plenty of product and plenty of options. And I think we'll be able to do it at a low cost and be able to do, you know, better clinical research because our budgets won't be consumed in so much in the development as they will in the actual cost of running a clinical trial properly.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. So I think we're a little out of time here.
Okay.
So, Skip, I thank you for your time and your effort and all the work that you do. And maybe somewhere down the line we'll do another show when things change or if something else comes down the road.
Yeah, you know, I would like to do one on the rise of virtual humans in clinical VR because that's the next big step in VR, not just building environments but populating them with AI driven virtual human characters. And so I'll leave you with that and look forward
okay.
to our
and,
next
and what
chat.
I'll do is I'll leave a link to your YouTube channel below this so people could tap into your YouTubes and see what you're doing. So I thank you again, Skip, and until next time, this is Dr. Gurr for The Shrink Is In.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gurr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gurr, go to his website at www.drsgurr.com.